I don't think I could bear that. Mary Taylor sat on the arm of the sofa beside her daughter-in-law and stroked her hair. We'll weather it, Jeannie. We have so far. Perhaps they'll leave you alone now. The remark was aimed at the two detectives cluttering up the sitting room, as much as the press waiting outside. They've been knocking since 8 a.m. I've told them Jean is too upset to talk, but then another one comes. I think she should come back with me for a bit, but she wants to stay at home. Glenn is here, Jean said, and Sparks rose to leave.
Chapter 48 The Widow. Thursday, May 27th, 2010. The funeral happened so quickly. I let Mary choose the hymns and readings. Couldn't think straight, and wouldn't have known what to pick. She went for the safe options. Amazing Grace, and The Lord is My Shepherd, because everyone knows the tunes. Which was lucky, as there were only 15 of us singing in the crematorium chapel. We went to see Glenn in the Chapel of Rest, all smart in his three-piece bank suit and the navy and gold tie he liked. I'd washed and ironed his best shirt, and it looked perfect. Glenn would have been pleased. Of course, it wasn't really Glenn in the coffin. He wasn't there, if you know what I mean. He looked like a waxwork Glenn. His mum wept, and I stood back, letting her have a moment with her little boy. I kept looking at his hands with their perfect pink buffed-up nails. Innocent hands. Mary and I went from the funeral home to John Lewis to buy hats. You'll find the range over there, the assistant pointed, and we stood in front of 30 black hats, trying to imagine ourselves at Glenn's funeral. I picked a sort of pillbox one, with a little net veil to hide my eyes, and Mary went for one with a brim. They cost a fortune, but neither of us could summon the energy to mind. We came out into the street with our carrier bags and stood, lost for a moment. Come on, Jeannie, let's go home and have a cup of tea, Mary said. So we did. The next day we put on the new hats in front of the mirror in the hall, before getting into the taxi to the crematorium. Mary and I held hands loosely, just touching. Glenn's dad stared out the window at the drizzle. Always rains at funerals, he said. What a bloody awful day. Funny things, funerals. So much like weddings, I think. Gatherings with people you never see any other time. Catching up over a buffet. People laughing and crying. Even at Glenn's funeral, I heard one of the old uncles laughing quietly with someone. When we arrived, we were guided into the waiting area, me with my mum and dad, his mum and dad, and a small crowd of tailors. I was grateful anyone came, really. No one from the bank or the salon. We were not part of that world anymore. Then Bob Sparks turned up, all respectful in black suit and tie, looking like an undertaker. He stood apart from us, on the edge of the Garden of Remembrance, pretending to read the names of the dead on the plaques. He hadn't sent flowers, but we told people not to. Family flowers only, the undertaker had advised. So there was just my wreath of lilies and laurels. Classic and classy, the young florist had said, almost chirpily. And Mary had ordered Glenn's name in white chrysanthemums. He'd have hated it. How common, I could hear him say. But Mary loved it, and that's what mattered. I kept looking to see where Bob Sparks was. Who invited him? Mary said, all cross. Don't worry about him, love. George patted her shoulder. Not important today. The vicar from Mary's church did the service, talking about Glenn like he was a real person, not the man in the papers. He kept looking at me like he was talking just to me. I hid behind the veil on my hat when he was going on about Glenn as if he knew him. He talked about his football and his cleverness at school and his wonderfully supportive wife during difficult times. There was a murmur from the congregation, and I rested my head on my dad's shoulder and closed my eyes while his coffin slid forward and the curtains closed behind him. All gone. Outside, I looked for Bob Sparks, but he had gone as well. Everyone wanted to kiss and hug me and tell me how fantastic I'd been. I managed a smile and hugged people back. And then it was over. We'd thought about putting on a tea, but we didn't know if anyone would come. And then if there'd been a tea, we would have had to talk about Glenn, and someone might have mentioned Bella. We kept it simple. The five of us went home to my house and had a cup of tea and some ham sandwiches Mary had made and put in the fridge. I put my hat in its tissue paper and John Lewis bag and slid it on top of the wardrobe. Later, the house was quiet for the first time since Glenn died, and I put on my dressing gown and wandered through all the rooms. It isn't a big house, but Glenn was in every corner of it, and I kept expecting to hear him shout to me, "Jeannie, where have you put the paper? Off to work, love. See you later." In the end, I made a drink and took it up to bed with the handful of cards and letters from the family. I'd burned the nasty ones on the stovetop. The bed felt bigger without him. He wasn't always in it. Sometimes he slept on the sofa downstairs when he was restless. "Don't want to keep you awake, Jean," he'd say, and pick up his pillow. He didn't want to go in the spare room anymore, so he'd got a sofa that pulled out into a bed, and he'd crawl into it in the middle of the night. We kept a duvet behind it during the day. I didn't know if anyone noticed.
Chapter 49. The Detective. Saturday, June 12th, 2010. After the funeral, Bob Sparks read the coverage and looked at the photographs of Jean at the crematorium and a close-up of the word Glenn spelled out in flowers. "How will we find you now, Bella?" the papers said, taunting him. He tried to concentrate on the job, but found himself staring into space, lost and unable to move forward. He decided to take some leave and get his head together. "Let's pack up the car and drive to Devon. Find a place to stay when we get there," he said to Eileen on Saturday morning. She went to talk to the neighbour about feeding the cat, and he sat at the table with the post. Eileen crashed in through the back door, her hands full of runner beans and peas. "Pick them quickly, otherwise they'll be over by the time we get back. Shame to waste them." Eileen was clearly determined that life would go on in their house, even if it was stuck on pause in her husband's head. He'd always been a thinker. It had been what she loved about him. Deep, her friends had said. She liked that, his deepness. But now, it was just blackness. "Come on, Bob, finish shelling these peas while I pack a bag. How long are we going for?" "A week? What do you think? Just need a bit of clean air and long walks." "Sounds lovely." He did his chore mechanically, sliding a nail along the pod and pushing the peas into a colander as he struggled with his feelings. He'd let it get personal, he knew. No other case had touched him like this, had reduced him to tears, had threatened his career. Maybe he ought to go back to the crazy counselor. He laughed, just a short bark of a laugh. But Eileen heard it and rushed downstairs to see what had happened. The journey was painless. It was a warm summer's day before the school holidays, with little traffic on the motorways, that Sparks took to put distance between him and the case as quickly as possible. Eileen sat close to him, occasionally patting his knee or squeezing his hand. They both felt young and slightly giddy at their spontaneity. Eileen chatted to him about the children, filling him in on his family, as if he were emerging from a coma. "Sam says she and Pete will get married next summer. She wants to do it on a beach." "A beach? Suppose it won't be Margate. Well, whatever she wants. She seems happy with Pete, doesn't she?"
"Very happy, Bob. It's James I'm worried about.
He's working too hard. Wonder where he gets that from, he said, and glanced at his wife to see her reaction. They smiled at each other, and Sparks's stomach began to unclench for the first time in weeks. Months, really. It was wonderful to be talking about his own life instead of other people's. They decided to stop at Exmouth for crab sandwiches. They had brought the kids there for a summer holiday when they were little, and it held memories of being happy. It was all still there when they pulled up. The blue pom-poms of the hydrangeas, the flags fluttering around the Jubilee clock tower, the screeching seagulls, the pastel shades of the beach huts. It was as if they had stepped back into the 1990s. And they walked along the promenade to stretch their legs and look at the sea. Come on, love. Let's get going. I'll phone the pub to book a room for tonight, he said, and then pulled her to him and kissed her. Another hour or so and they'd be at Dartmouth, and then on to Slapton Sands for a fish supper. They drove with the windows down and the wind blowing their hair into mad shapes. Blowing the badness out, Eileen said, as he knew she would. It was what she always said. It made him think of Glenn Taylor, but he didn't say anything. At the pub, they sprawled on the benches outside, soaking up the last warmth of the sun and planning their swim in the morning. Let's get up early and go, he suggested. Let's not. Let's give ourselves a lie-in and then meander down. We've got all week, Bob, she said, and laughed at the thought of a whole week to themselves. They went up to their room late, and, from habit, Sparks clicked on the television to catch the late news while Eileen had a quick shower. The video clip of Jean Taylor sitting in her living room, being interviewed, made his stomach contract into its familiar knot, and he was back in role. Eileen, love, I've got to go back, he called through to her. It's Jean Taylor. She says Glenn took Bella. Eileen came out of the bathroom, wrapped in a towel, with another pulled around her wet hair in a turban. What? What did you say? Then she saw the faces on the television and sank down on the bed. Christ, Bob. Is there no end to this? No, Eileen. I'm so sorry. But there isn't until I know what happened to that little girl. Jean knows, and I've got to ask her again. Can you be ready to leave in 15 minutes? She nodded, loosening the towel on her head and rubbing her hair dry. The journey back was quiet. Eileen slept as Sparks drove on deserted roads, flicking on the radio every hour on the hour to see if there were any updates. He had to shake his wife awake when they reached home, and they fell into bed with barely a word exchanged.
Chapter 50. The Reporter. Sunday, June 13th, 2010.
Here she is, our star reporter, the editor shouted across the newsroom when Kate walked in the next morning. Brilliant exclusive, Kate. Well done. There was a smattering of applause from her colleagues and calls of, "Great stuff, Kate!" She felt herself blushing and tried to smile without looking smug.
"Thanks, Simon," she said when she finally reached her desk and could shrug off her handbag and jacket. The news editor had already sidled over to bask in any glory being handed out.
"What have we got for day two, then, Kate? Another scoop?" the editor bawled, yellow teeth bared in triumph.
Kate knew the editor knew because she had filed it overnight, but Simon Pearson wanted to put on a bit of a show in front of his people. He hadn't had much of a chance lately.
"Bloody boring politics. Where are the exclusives?" was his mantra, and today he was going to make the most of it. "We've got the story of the childless marriage," Terry said. "Is this what turned Mr. Normal into a monster?"
Simon smiled widely. Kate winced. The headline was crass and screamed, turning her probing and sensitive interview into a cinema poster. But she should have been used to it.
Sell the story, was another of the editor's mantras. He was a man for mantras. Brute force and rote learning was his preferred MO with his executives, none of your pretentious creative thinking and questioning. Simon says, the execs joked. The editor knew a good headline and believed it was always worth using a good one more than once. Every week, sometimes, when it particularly took his fancy, then promptly discarded when even he realized it was becoming the source of derision in journalist drinking holes. The question in the headline, "Is this the most evil man in Britain?" was a classic. It hedged bets, just asking, not saying. "I've got some good quotes from the widow," Kate said, starting up her computer. "Killer quotes," Terry added, upping the ante. "Everyone was scrambling to catch up last night, and we've had the magazines and foreign press on already for the pictures. Talk of the street." "You're showing your age, Terry," Simon said. "There's no street anymore. Didn't you know? It's a global village." The news editor grinned at his boss's rebuke, determined to see it as a bit of banter. Nothing was going to spoil today. He'd brought in the story of the year and was going to go in and get the pay raise he richly deserved and then take his wife, or maybe his mistress, for dinner at the Ritz. Kate was already looking at her emails, leaving the men to their dick swinging. "What's she like, Kate? Jean Taylor?" Kate looked at her editor and saw the genuine curiosity behind the bluster. He had one of the most powerful jobs in the newspaper industry, but what he really wanted was to be a reporter again, elbow deep in the story, asking the questions, standing on a doorstep and sending his golden words to the desk, not just hearing about it later. "She's smarter than she makes out. Puts on the little housewifey act, you know, standing by her man, but there's all sorts going on in her head. Difficult for her because I think she believed he was innocent at one stage, but something changed. Something changed in their relationship." Kate knew she should have got more. She should have got the whole thing. She blamed Mick for interrupting, but she'd seen the shutters come down in Jean's eyes. Control of the interview had switched back and forth between the two women, but there was no question who'd been in charge at the end. Kate wasn't about to admit that to this audience. The other reporters were listening now, wheeling their chairs back to catch the conversation. "Did he do it, Kate? And did she know?" the crime man asked. "That's what everyone wants to know." "Yes and yes," she said. "Question is, when did she know? At the time or later? I think the trouble is that she's been stuck between what she knows and what she wants to believe." Everyone looked at her for more, and, as if on cue, Kate's phone began ringing, and Bob Sparks's name flashed up. "Sorry, got to take this, Simon. It's the copper in charge of the case. Might be a day three." "Keep me posted, Kate," he said as he marched off to his office, and she moved through the swinging doors to the lifts to get a bit of privacy. "Hello, Bob. Thought I'd hear from you this morning." Sparks was already standing outside the newspaper office, sheltering from summer rain in the grand portico of the building. "Come and have a coffee with me, Kate. We need to talk." The Italian cafe around the corner in a grubby side street was crowded, and the windows were running with steam from the coffee machine. They sat down at a table away from the counter and looked at each other for a minute.
"Congratulations, Kate. You got her to say more than I ever managed."
The reporter held his gaze. His generosity disarmed her, made her want to tell him the truth. He was good, she had to admit. "I should have got more, Bob. There was more to get, but she stopped when she chose. Incredible self-control. Frightening, really. One minute she was holding my hand and literally crying on my shoulder about the monster she married, and the next she was back in the driver's seat, clammed up and wouldn't budge." She stirred her coffee. "She knows what happened, doesn't she?" Sparks nodded.
"I think she does, but she can't let it out, and I don't know why. After all, he's dead. What has she got to lose?
Kate shook her head in sympathy. Something, obviously. I've often wondered if she was involved in the crime, Sparks said, mainly to himself. Maybe the planning? Maybe it was about getting a child for them both and something went wrong. Perhaps she put him up to it.
Kate's eyes were glittering with the possibilities. Bloody hell, Bob. How are you going to get her to confess?
How indeed, he thought. What is her weak point? Kate asked, playing with her spoon.
Glenn, he answered, but he's not here anymore.
It's kids, Bob. That's her weak point. She's obsessed with them. Everything came back to kids when we were talking. She wanted to know everything about my boys.
I know. You should see her scrapbooks full of babies.
Scrapbooks?
That's off the record, Kate.
She tucked it away for later and automatically put her head on one side. Submission. You can trust me.
He wasn't fooled. I mean it. It could be part of a future investigation.
Okay, okay, she conceded irritably. What do you think she'll do now?
If she knew anything, she might go back to the child, Sparks said.
Back to Bella, Kate echoed, wherever she is. Jean had nothing else to think about now. She'd make a move, he was sure.
Will you call me if you hear anything? He asked Kate.
I might, she teased automatically. He flushed, and despite herself, she was pleased to see him respond to her flirty tone. Sparks felt out of his depth suddenly.
Kate, we're not playing games here, he said, trying to get back on a professional footing. Let's stay in touch.
They parted in the street, and he tried to shake her hand, but she leaned forward to kiss him on the cheek.
Chapter 51. The Widow. Friday, June 11th, 2010. When the crew has gone, I sit quietly and wait for the late evening news. Mr. Telly had said it'll be the top item, and it is. Widow in Bella case speaks out for first time, flashes up on the screen, and music rolls over it and into my front room. And there I am, on the telly. It doesn't last very long, really, but I say I knew nothing about Bella's disappearance, but suspected that Glenn was involved. I said very clearly that I didn't know for certain, that he had not confessed to me, that journalists had twisted what I said. I answered their questions calmly, sitting on my sofa. I admitted I was offered payment, but had turned it down when I found out what the paper was printing. There was a curt statement from the Daily Post, and a shot of Kate and Mick leaving my house. And that was it. I wait for the phone to ring. First was Glenn's mum, Mary. How could you say those things, Jeannie, she says. You know as well as I do, Mary, I say. Please don't pretend you didn't suspect him of it, because I know you did. She goes quiet and says she will talk to me tomorrow. Then Kate calls. She's businesslike, saying that the paper is including my statement from the TV interview in their article, so I can give my side of the story. I laugh at the cheek of her. You were supposed to be writing my side of the story, I say. Do you always lie to your victims? She ignores the question and says I can ring her any time on her mobile, and I hang up without saying goodbye. The paper comes through the letterbox the next morning. I don't have deliveries. I wonder if Kate posted it. Or a neighbour. The headline screams, Widow confesses Bella killer's guilt. And I'm shaking too much to open the paper. My picture is on the front, gazing into the distance like Mick told me to. I put it down on the kitchen table and wait. The phone rings all morning. The papers, the telly, the radio, the family. My mum calls, sobbing about the shame I have brought on them. And my dad is shouting in the background about how he warned me not to marry Glenn. He didn't, but I suppose he wishes he had done now. I try to comfort Mum, telling her I have been misquoted and the paper has twisted everything. but it's no good, and in the end she hangs up. I feel exhausted by it, so I take the phone off the hook and lie down on my bed. I think about Bella and Glenn, and those last few days before he died. He'd started asking me what I was going to do. "Are you going to leave me, Jeannie?" he'd said. I said I was going to make a cup of tea, and left him standing there. Too much to think about. Betrayal. Decisions. Plans. And I don't speak to him again, except when it is essential. "It's your mum on the phone. Just the bare minimum." He's like a ghost, haunting me everywhere in the house. I catch him looking at me from behind the paper. I have him now. He doesn't know what his genie will do, and it scares him to death. Glenn doesn't let me out on my own that week. Everywhere I go, he comes too. Perhaps he thinks I will go straight to Bob Sparks. That's because he doesn't understand a thing about me. I'm not going to tell anyone anything. Not to protect him. Don't make me laugh. That Saturday, he was on my heels as we came out of Sainsbury's, and I saw him look at a little girl sitting in a supermarket cart. It was just a glance, but I saw something in his eyes, something dead, and I pushed him away from the child. Such a little push, and he tripped on the curb and into the road. The bus appeared at the same moment. It was also quick. And I remember looking at him lying there, in a small pool of blood, and thinking, oh well, that's the end of his nonsense. Does it make me a murderer now? I look at myself in the mirror, try to see if it shows in my eyes, but I don't think so. Glenn got off lightly, really. He could have gone on suffering for years, wondering when he'd be exposed. People like Glenn can't help themselves, I've heard. So really, I helped him out. I'm going to sell the house as soon as I can. I've got to get through the inquest first, but Tom Payne says it'll be very straightforward. I just have to tell the coroner about Glenn stumbling over his feet, and it'll all be over. I can make my own fresh start. I rang an estate agent yesterday to find out what the house will fetch. I gave my name, but she didn't seem to notice. She will eventually. But I told her I wanted a quick sale, and she's coming tomorrow morning. I wonder if Glenn's connection will put the price up or down. Some ghoul might pay a bit extra. You never know. I'm still deciding where to go, but I'm definitely moving out of London. I'm going to go online to find places, maybe abroad, or maybe down toward Hampshire, to be near my baby girl.
Chapter 52. The Reporter. Thursday, July 1st, 2010. The coroner was well known to the press, a small, neat lawyer who favoured highly coloured silk bow ties and kept a meticulously trimmed silver moustache. Hugh Holden liked to think of himself as a character, an occasional thorn in the side of the authorities, unafraid to reach controversial verdicts. Normally, Kate enjoyed his inquests and his quirky line in questioning and verbal flourishes, but she wasn't in the mood today. She feared this was likely to be Jean Taylor's last public appearance. There'd be no need for her to show her face again, and she could disappear behind her front door forever. Outside the court, Mick was milling with the other photographers, waiting for the arrival shots.
"Hi, Kate," he called over the heads. "See you after."
She filed in with the rest of the reporters and the curious, managing to get one of the last press seats at the front, facing the witness box. Her thoughts were all on Jean, and she watched the door for her entrance. She missed Zara Salmond slipping into the back of the court with some of the Met officers who'd be called to give evidence. Sparks had sent her in his place.
You go, Salmond. I need your eyes and analysis on her performance. I can't see anything straight at the moment.
She'd arrived only just in time, when the grind of the door hinges announced the widow. Jean Taylor looked dignified and in control, in the same dress she'd worn for Glenn's funeral. She walked slowly through the court with her lawyer to her seat in the front row.
That weasel Tom Paine, Kate thought, nodding affably to him and mouthing, "Good morning, Tom."
He raised his hand in greeting, and Jean looked to see who he was waving to. Their eyes met, and Kate thought for a moment that she was going to acknowledge her. She tried a small smile, but Jean turned away, uninterested. The other witnesses took their time to settle, shaking hands and hugging one another in the aisles. But finally, everyone took their places and stood to attention as the coroner entered. The coroner's officer stepped up to tell the court that the deceased's father had identified the body as that of Glenn George Taylor, and then the pathologist gave his evidence of the post-mortem examination. Kate kept her eyes on the widow, registering her reactions to the details of the dissection of her husband. He'd had a good last breakfast anyway, Kate thought, as the pathologist ran through the contents of the stomach in desultory fashion. No sign of disease. Contusions and lacerations to arms and thighs consistent with the fall and collision with the vehicle. The fatal injury was to the head. Skull fracture caused by impact with bus and road surface. Traumatic brain injury. Death pretty much instantaneous. Jean pulled her handbag onto her knee and undid a small packet of tissues ostentatiously, unfolding one to wipe an eye.
She's not crying, Kate thought. She's faking.
The bus driver was next. His tears were real as he told of the flash of a man falling in front of his cab window.
I never saw him, so there was nothing I could do. It all happened so quickly. I braked. But it was too late.
He was helped from the box by an usher, and then Jean was called. Her performance was polished, too polished. To Kate's ear, every word sounded like it had been practiced in front of the mirror. The shopping trip was walked through step by step, around the aisles, out of the automatic doors and into the high street. The discussion about cereal and Glenn Taylor's stumble into the path of the bus, all told in a low, serious voice. Kate wrote it all down and glanced up to capture the expressions and any emotions.
Mrs. Taylor, can you tell us why your husband stumbled? The police examined the pavement and could find nothing to make him lose his footing, the coroner said kindly.
I don't know, sir. He fell under the bus right there in front of me. I didn't even have time to call out. He was gone, the widow answered. She can do this without thinking now, Kate thought. She's using identical phrases.
Was he holding your hand or your arm? I know I do with my partner when we're out together, the coroner persisted.
No, well, perhaps. I can't remember, she said. Less sure of herself now.
Was your husband distracted that day? Was he himself?
Distracted? What do you mean?
Not concentrating on what he was doing, Mrs. Taylor.
He'd a lot on his mind, Jean Taylor said, and looked at the press benches. But I'm sure you know that.
Quite, the coroner said, pleased with himself for prying out some new information. So what was his mood that morning?
His mood?
This was not going the way Jean had planned, Kate thought. Repeating questions back to the questioner was a sure sign of stress. You did it to buy time. The reporter leaned forward to make sure she didn't miss a word.
Yes, his mood, Mrs. Taylor.
Jean Taylor closed her eyes and seemed to sway in the witness box. Tom Paine and the coroner's officer leapt up to catch her and lower her into a chair as the court hummed with concern.
It's a line, I suppose,
the reporter behind Kate muttered to a colleague.
Widow of Bella suspect collapses, better than nothing.
It's not over yet,
she hissed over her shoulder. Jean gripped a glass of water and stared at the coroner.
Better now, Mrs. Taylor? He asked.
Yes, thank you. Sorry about that. I didn't eat anything this morning, and
that's perfectly all right. No need to explain. Now, shall we get back to my question?
Jean took a deep breath.
He hadn't been sleeping properly, not for ages, and he'd been getting bad headaches.
And had he been treated for his insomnia and headaches?
She shook her head.
He said he wasn't well, but he wouldn't go to the doctor. He didn't want to talk about it, I think.
I see. Why not, Mrs. Taylor? She looked at her lap for a moment, then raised her head.
Because he said he kept dreaming about Bella Elliot.
Hugh Holden held her gaze, and the room stilled as he nodded to encourage her to continue.
She was there when he closed his eyes, he said. It was making him ill, and he wanted to be with me all the time, following me around the house. I didn't know what to do. He wasn't well.
The coroner noted it all down carefully as the reporters scribbled furiously to his left.
Given his state of mind, Mrs. Taylor, is there a possibility that your husband stepped in front of the bus on purpose? The coroner asked.
Tom Paine rose to challenge the question, but Jean waved him away.
I don't know, sir. He never said anything about taking his own life, but he wasn't well.
The coroner thanked her for her evidence, gave her his condolences, and recorded a verdict of accidental death.
I'll be on the news tonight, he told the court usher gleefully, as the press filed out.
Chapter 53 The Detective Thursday, July 1st, 2010 Glenn Taylor's dreams of Bella led the news bulletins on the radio all afternoon and came a respectable third on the evening television news. In the dog days of summer, the media's silly season, when politicians are on holiday, schools close, and the country gently grinds to a halt, anything with a hint of a news angle plays well. Sparks had heard it all from Salmon straight after the inquest, but he read it anyway, scanning every word in the papers. Jean's beginning to unravel, Bob, Salmon had said, puffing slightly as she marched back to her car. I tried to talk to her afterward. All the reporters were there. Your Kate Waters was there. But Jean wouldn't say another word. She's still in charge, but only just. The collapse in court must be a sign that with Glenn gone, the secret was becoming too much for her, Sparks felt. She's trying to let it seep out in a controlled way, like when they used to bleed a patient in medieval times. Getting rid of the bad thing a bit at a time, he'd suggested to Salmon. He looked over at his sergeant. She was now sitting at his computer to look at the news reports. We're going to wait her out, literally. They were in position at 5 a.m. the next morning, parked out of sight, half a mile from the Taylor house, waiting for the surveillance team's call. I know this is a long shot, but we've got to try it. She will do something, he told her. Feel it in your waters, sir, she said. Not sure where my waters are, but yes, I do. 12 hours later, the air in the car was thick with their breath and fast food. At 10 p.m., they had exhausted their life stories, criminals they'd arrested, holiday disasters, TV programs from their childhoods, favorite meals, best action films, and who was sleeping with whom in the office. Sparks felt he could go on Mastermind and answer questions on Zara Salmon without passing. And both were quietly relieved when the surveillance team finally rang to say all the lights in the house had been turned off. Sparks called it a day. They would stay in the cheap hotel down the hill to grab some sleep before resuming their vigil. Another team would keep watch overnight. His phone rang at 4 a.m. "Lights are on, sir." He pulled on his clothes and rang Salmond at the same time, dropping his phone down a trouser leg. "Sir, is that you?" "Yes, yes, she's up. Downstairs in 5. Zara Salmond looked less than perfect for the first time. Bed hair and bare-faced, she was waiting for him at the front door. "And to think I told my mum I wanted to be an air hostess," she said. "Come on, then. Seats for takeoff," he replied, with the ghost of a smile. Jean came out of the front door quickly, triggering her own security light, and stood in the spotlight, looking up and down the street for signs of life. She pressed the key fob to open the car, and the electronic beep echoed off the facades of the houses opposite as she pulled open the door and slid in behind the wheel. She was wearing her funeral dress again. 2 streets away, Zara Salmond started their car and waited for instructions from the team. Sparks was deep in thought beside her, maps on his lap. "She's just turned onto the A2 headed in the direction of the M25, sir." The officer in the unmarked van barked down the phone, and they pulled away to start their pursuit. "Bet she's going down to Hampshire," Salmond said as she sped down the dual carriageway. "Let's not try to second-guess her," Spark said. He could not bear to hope too much as he followed their route on the map with his finger. The rising sun was beginning to lighten the sky, but the GPS had still not switched from night colours when they took the turn-off for the M3 and Southampton. The convoy was evenly spaced over 3 miles of the motorway, with Sparks and Salmond holding back to avoid being recognised. "She's signalling to pull into the services, sir," the van informed. "Where are your officers now? We'll need to change over, or she's going to spot us." "On it. We've got another vehicle waiting at the next junction. Stick with her until she leaves the services, and we'll take her from there," Sparks replied. The van crawled into the parking area and slid into a bay 2 cars back from the target. One of the police team got out, scratching his head and stretching, and headed after Jean Taylor. She went into the ladies' room, and the officer stood in a queue for a burger. He pretended to compare the qualities of the meals advertised in nuclear fallout colours above the counter, while he waited for her to emerge. She didn't take long, shaking the last drops of water from her hands as she walked. The officer munched into his double cheeseburger as she went into the shop and carefully picked through the plastic buckets of flowers, selecting a bouquet of pink rosebuds and white lilies wrapped in pink tissue paper and cellophane. She held them up to her face to catch the perfume from the powdery stamens as she walked over to the sweet counter and picked up a brightly coloured packet. Skittles, the officer noted from the other side of the deserted shop. Then she queued to pay. "She's got flowers and sweets, sir. She's on her way to the car. We'll follow her out onto the motorway and hand over," he reported back. Sparks and Salmond looked at each other. "She's going to a grave," he said, his mouth dry. "Get our boys ready." 5 minutes later, 2 other vehicles were on her tail, overtaking each other, taking turns to be 3 cars back. Jean maintained a steady 65 miles per hour. A careful driver. "She's probably not used to driving on motorways on her own," Sparks thought. "I wonder if this is the first time she's made this journey." He and Salmond had not spoken since they turned out of the services. They were concentrating on the chatter on the police channels. But at Winchester, when they heard Jean Taylor's car had exited and was heading east, he told her to put her foot down. They were picking up a bit more traffic, but Jean's car was now only a mile ahead of them, with another police vehicle sandwiched between them. "She's stopping," the officer messaged. "Trees on right, track, no gate. I'll have to go on, or she'll spot me. We'll double back straight away. She's all yours.
Steady, Salmond, Spark said. Nice and steady.
They almost missed her car, tucked down the muddy track. But Spark spotted the glint of metal in the trees at the last minute.
She's here, he said.
And Salmond slowed and swung their car around.
Park across the road. We'll need access for the other vehicles, he said.
As they got out, a light rain started to patter down on the trees, and they pulled their coats from the boot.
She's probably heard the car, Sparks whispered. I don't know how far back these trees go. I'll go ahead, and you wait for the team. I'll call you when I need you.
Salmond nodded, looking suddenly tearful. He crossed the road quickly, turning and waving before disappearing into the trees. There was not enough daylight yet to penetrate the woods, and he felt his way carefully. He couldn't hear anything apart from his breathing and the crows cawing above him, disturbed by his presence. He suddenly saw a movement ahead, a flash of something white in the gloom. He stopped and waited a moment until he was ready. He needed to steady himself, and was glad Salmond wasn't there to see him trembling like a diver on a high board. He took three deep breaths, and then moved forward, cautiously. He was worried he might stumble over her. He didn't want to frighten her. Then he saw her, on the ground, under a tree. She was sitting on a coat, her legs tucked sideways, for all the world as if she were at a picnic. Beside her, the flowers in their tissue paper. Is that you, Bob? He froze at the sound of Jean's voice.
Yes, Jean.
I thought I heard a car.
I knew it would be you. Why are you here, Jean?
Jeannie. I prefer you to call me Jeannie,
she said, still not looking at him.
Why are you here, Jeannie?
I've come to see our baby girl.
Sparks crouched down beside her, then took off his coat and sat on it so he could be close to her.
Who is your baby girl, Jeannie?
Bella, of course. She's here. Glenn put her here.
Chapter 54. The Widow. Saturday, July 3rd, 2010. I couldn't stop myself. I had to go to her. The interview and the inquest started something in me, started me thinking all the time, and even the pills couldn't do anything about it. I thought that with Glenn gone, there would be some peace. But there wasn't. I was still thinking all the time. I couldn't eat or sleep. I knew I had to go to her. Nothing else mattered. It wasn't the first visit. Glenn had taken me to Bella's grave on the Monday before he died. After he sat on my bed and told me he couldn't sleep anymore, he started talking about the day Bella went missing. Curled up on his side of the bed, with his back to me, so I couldn't see his face. I didn't move once while he told me. I was scared I'd break the spell and he'd stop. So I listened without speaking. He said he'd picked Bella up because she'd wanted him to. He hadn't dreamed it. He knew that he'd left Bella on her own on the edge of a small wood on his way home to me. And he knew he'd done something terrible. She'd fallen asleep in the back of the van. He had a sleeping bag in the van. He just lifted her out, still asleep from the back of the van, and put her under a tree to be found. He'd left some sweets for her to eat, Skittles. He'd meant to ring the police, but he was in a panic. Then he got up and went out of the room before I could speak. I lay still, as if I could stop time there. But my mind was racing away from me. All I could think was, why did he have a sleeping bag in his van? Where did he get it from? I couldn't let myself think about what had happened in the van, what my husband had done. I wanted to blot it out, and I stood under the shower, letting the water drum on my head and fill my ears. But nothing could stop me from thinking. I went down to him in the kitchen and told him we were going to find her. Glenn looked at me blankly and said, "Jeannie, I left her nearly 4 years ago." But I wasn't taking no for an answer. "We have to," I said. We got in our car and went looking for Bella. I made sure we were not being watched as we came out, but the press didn't live on our street anymore. I'd already decided that if we saw one of the neighbours, we'd say we were going shopping at Bluewater. The traffic was heavy, and we didn't speak as we followed the signs for the M25. We followed the route Glenn must have taken that day from Winchester to Southampton, and then on the country roads he took with Bella in the back of his van. I imagined her sitting happily on the floor of the van with a fistful of sweeties, and I held on to that image for grim death. I knew it wasn't like that, really, but I couldn't think about that yet. Glenn was pale and sweaty at the wheel. "This is bloody stupid, Jean," he said. But I knew he wanted to go back to that day, to what happened. And I was letting him do this because I wanted Bella. About 2 hours after we left home, he said, "It was here." It didn't look any different from dozens of clumps of trees we'd passed, but he pulled over. "How can you be sure?" I asked. "I made a mark on the fence," he said. And there it was, a faded smear of car oil on a fence post. He meant to come back, I thought, then pushed the thought aside. Glenn drove the van off the road so it couldn't be seen. He must have done the same thing that day. Then we sat in silence. It was me who made the first move. "Come on," I said, and he undid his seatbelt. His face had gone blank again, like it did that day in the hall. He didn't look like Glenn anymore, but I wasn't frightened. He was shaking, but I didn't touch him. When we got out, he led me to a tree near the edge and pointed at the ground. "Here," he said. "This is where I put her." "Liar," I said, and he looked startled. "Where?" I demanded, my voice sounding like a shriek, scaring both of us. He led me deeper into the trees and then stopped. I could see nothing to show anyone was here before, but I believed he was telling the truth this time. "I put her down here," he said, and stumbled to his knees. I squatted down beside him, under the tree, and made him tell me all over again. She put her arms up to me. She was beautiful, Jeannie. And I just leaned over the wall and took her and put her in the van. When we stopped, I held her really close and stroked her hair. She liked it at first, laughed, and I kissed her cheek. I gave her a sweet, and she loved it. Then she went to sleep. She was dead, Glenn, not asleep. "Bella was dead," I said, and he started to sob. "I don't know why she died," he said. "I didn't kill her. I would know if I had, wouldn't I?" "Yes, you would," I said. "You do." All I could hear was his sobbing, but I thought he was crying for himself, not for the child he had murdered. He said, "Perhaps I held her too tight. I didn't mean to. It was like a dream, Jeannie. Then I covered her up with the sleeping bag and branches and things to keep her safe." I could see a shred of faded blue material caught in the roots of the tree. We were kneeling beside Bella's grave, and I stroked the ground, soothing her, letting her know she was safe now. "It's all right, my baby," I said. And for a second, Glenn thought I meant him. I got up and walked back to the car, and left him to make his own way. He'd left it unlocked, and when I got in, I fiddled with the GPS and marked this place. Home. I wasn't sure why, but it felt right. Glenn appeared, and we drove back without speaking. I looked out the window at the countryside, changing into suburbs, and planned for my future. Glenn had done something terrible, but I could care for Bella, look after her, and love her. I could be her forever mummy. And last night, I decided that I'd get up early and go. It'd be dark still, so no one would see me leave. I didn't sleep while I waited to go. I was scared. Scared of driving on the motorway. Glenn always drove when we went on long journeys. His department. But I made myself do it. For her. I stopped at the Surfaces because I wanted to buy some flowers to take with me. Some little pink rosebuds for her. She would like those. Small and pink and pretty like her. And some lilies for her grave. I wasn't sure if I was going to leave them there. Perhaps bring them home again, so I could look at them with her. I bought some sweets for Bella, too. I chose Skittles. But then I realized in the car that that was what Glenn had chosen. I threw them out the window. The GPS took me straight there. "You've reached your destination," it said. And I had. "Home," it said on the screen. I slowed down a bit to let the car behind overtake me, and then turned into the track. It was getting light by then, but it was still early enough that no one else was around. I walked into the trees and looked for Bella. I'd left the yellow cloth Glenn used to clean the windscreen, wedged beside the blue material, under the tree root where he left her. And I hoped it would still be there. The woods weren't very big, and I'd brought a little flashlight in case. It didn't take very long to find it. The cloth was there, a bit soggy from the rain. I'd planned what I'd do in my head. I'd say a prayer, and then talk to Bella. But in the end, I just wanted to sit and be near her. I spread my coat out, and sat down beside her, and showed her the flowers. I don't know how long I'd been there when I heard him. I knew it would be him who found me. Destiny, my mum would say. He was so gentle when he spoke to me, when he asked me why I was there. We both knew, of course, but he needed me to say it. Needed it so badly. So I told him. "I've come to see our baby girl." He thought I meant Glenn's and my baby girl. But Bella is Bob's and mine, really. He loves her as much as I do. Glenn never loved her. He just wanted her and took her. We sat for a bit, not talking. And then Bob told me the real story. The story Glenn couldn't tell me. He told me how Glenn had found Bella online and hunted her down. How the police had watched a recording of him following her and Dawn from nursery school, 4 days before he kidnapped her. How he had planned the whole thing. "He said he did it for me," I said. "He did it for himself, Jean." "He said I made him do it because I needed a baby so much. It was my fault. He did it because he loved me." Bob looked at me hard and said slowly, "Glenn took her for himself, Jean. No one else was to blame. Not Dawn. Not you. I felt like I was underwater and couldn't hear or see anything clearly. I felt like I was drowning. It felt like we had been there for hours when Bob helped me up and put my coat around my shoulders and took my hand to lead me away. I turned back and whispered, "Goodbye, darling." Then we walked toward the blue lights, flashing through the trees. I saw the funeral pictures on the television. A little white coffin with pink rosebuds on the lid. Hundreds of people went from all over the country. But I couldn't. Dawn got an injunction to stop me. We made an application to the court, but the judge agreed with the psychiatrist that it would be too much for me. I was still there, though. Bella knew I was there. And that's all that matters. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Widow by Fiona Barton. Read for you by Hannah Curtis as The Widow, Nicholas Guy Smith as the detective, Mandy Williams as the reporter, Jane Entwistle as the mother, and Steve West as the husband. This program was directed by Erin Spencer. Executive producer, Janet Stark. Text copyright 2016 by Fiona Barton. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.